Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one, we preview for you a delightful comedy that opens tonight at the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Kenosha, presented by the Lakeside Players. In part two, we'll catch up with French horn virtuoso Rachel Velvicus. She has been the Howard Brown Artist in Residence at the University of Wisconsin Parkside all week, and she is soloing tomorrow night with the UW Parkside Orchestra and their conductor, Alvaro Garcia. Stay with us. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And tonight at the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Kenosha, a very intriguing play is opening, and you'll get a good sense of it probably just from its wildly wide-ranging title, Death of a Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf. So needless to say, this is not a serious night of theater. This is meant to be a night of fun and something of a spoof of certainly three great works and perhaps many more than that. So I'm really happy that I have with me three cast members for this production, Philip Yeager, Neil Rutassel, and Clara Tappa, who are respectively George, Stanley Kowalski, and Blanche Dubois in this production, which again opens tonight and runs this weekend and the next weekend, six performances in all at the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Kenosha. We welcome all of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. So, Phil Yeager, you reached out to me to make this interview happen. So, I'm going to start with you and have you give something of an overview of this intriguing play. What can you tell us about what you knew about it before undertaking it?
Well, I heard about it about 3.5 years ago. It was being done by the Second City of Chicago, and the title alone, you know, made me want to know more about it. We had done a show similar to it about 10, 15 years ago called The Glass Mendacity, which was just about Tennessee Williams characters, but it mixed three different plays together with all these people. This one, of course, takes more than, actually, there's like four major plays that are used for characters: Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Death of a Salesman, Streetcar Named Desire, and Our Town. And what I did was I contacted the author, Tim Sniffen, and asked him about how we would get rights to it, because at the time it was still not, you know, out there already. And he gave me the information, and I contacted the agent for Second City and started to negotiate with them. And then, of course, I had to get it approved by the people at Lakeside Players. And, I mean, as soon as I saw the script and read it, I was, you know, I knew it was a wonderful chance for us to do something that we've always found, you know, pleasurable to do, these spoofs. It's labeled on our poster a parody, you know, and it does follow the way the original plays were written. Some of the dialogue is very similar, but it's just exaggerated or comic enough for you to know it's not really a serious version of Stanley and Blanche or George and Martha. It's a comic look at them, but it's a thrill for all of us, especially those of us who've actually played some of these characters in the past.
Yes.
I mean, I played George at Rhodey Opera House, I think it was 7 years ago, and so did the lady who's playing opposite me, Kim Emer, played Martha, and Clara Tappa played Emily in Our Town, and she gets to play her again in this version. We all play a few other characters beside these, so... it's been just a joy working with everybody, especially our latest addition to Lakeside Players, Neil Rutassel. He's new to the group, and he's been, you know, just a lot of fun.
It's a heck of a way to begin, right?
I guess so.
Yeah, thrown into the deep end of the pool.
These guys really know how to make it hard on a guy.
Phil, did you say that you actually saw this play at Second City, or you heard of it?
I'd heard of it. I read reviews. I wanted to go see it. I was not able to get down. It had a limited run in Glencoe. There are excerpts of it on YouTube. I didn't see it. I just got the script, and when I read the script and I lent it to some friends, they were like, we've got to do this. This is just wonderful material. I would just love to see it at Lakeside Players. So, yeah, that was the initial impetus for us to go for it. It took me a couple years to get it through the whole committee business, but I'm so thrilled we're actually doing it now. And I tried to get Mr. Sniffen to come see it, but he's unavailable, but he's encouraging us to, you know, anyone in the area who he knows to come see it, you know, in the Kenosha area.
So. Fantastic. And I think it's really cool, the whole experience of going after work that has not even yet been really publicly disseminated for companies to do. And I suppose that's any playwright's dream, is for them to have community theaters come knocking at the door, eager to do their new work.
I have a feeling I probably was the first person to contact him about the rights, you know, and I'm going back three and a half years ago. But it has been performed in a few other locales. In fact, one of my acting friends down in, I think he's living in Florida now, said it was just done recently down there. So it has been done. It's not widely known, I don't think, right now, but I'm pretty sure it's the Kenosha County premiere of this show. And I think the fact that it was fostered by people at Second City, and if you've ever seen any of their performances, you know their material is pretty spot on.
Oh, yeah. It's a first-rate organization, so you're wise to, you know, anything that they do is, you know, it's going to be first-rate. Well, this sounds certainly intriguing. So, Clara Tappa, so you are, I know, Blanche DuBois, and you're also from our town. What's the character?
Emily.
Okay. Anybody else or those two characters? Not that that's not plenty.
Those two are enough in this one, yeah.
She does Amanda a little from Glass Menagerie.
One line from Amanda,
oh,
yes.
Very good. And Neil Rutassel, you are Stanley Kowalski, and anybody else?
I think I end up as a passenger on a train and a bartender somewhere and something else. George Webb. No, Mr. Webb.
Oh, Mr. Webb from our town.
Right.
What else? A scary, aggressive boss.
Yeah, you're the mean boss from Death of a Salesman who fires Willie Loman.
All incredible.
It's an incredibly silly, funny scene they do. It's so, you know, it sounds so much like the actual scene, but it's, I don't want to give anything away, but it's really, really.
It's like a Naked Gun version of it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
there you go. That's a good. So who would like to try to sketch out for us kind of the way in which all of these plays are blended together? I mean, is this a play that has a plot? I mean, does it have a narrative arc? And if so, what are at least the basic elements of it that we need to know about?
It does. There is a narrator throughout the show, and he kind of course, pulls it all together. But there's a plot that brings all of these characters together down in New Orleans, as they say, as a kind of a reunion for some of the characters. And then others are there as guests, and it brings them all together on an evening.
There's a great line in the play where the narrator says, it's like Million Dollar Quartet without the singing or the joy.
That is a good, that gives us some sense, yeah.
Very good. So we follow these characters through this crazy evening, and it culminates at the end with us talking about Phil's character talking about the parody of all of us and our characters. it's fun. It's delightful. It's poignant at times, but you will definitely go away laughing.
Wow. So do we have interaction between characters then that have nothing to do with each other?
Oh, that's part of the real comic element of this. You know, Martha, my wife, interacts a lot with Blanche Dubois. I interact with Stanley Kowalski. We have a scene where we all go to, I go with him to the bowling alley. And some of his cronies are there, and it's, it's a real over the top scene, especially for Stanley, because his temper just goes wild, and he starts throwing a lot of bowling balls. You know, we don't have real bowling balls, obviously we can't. One of the things I want to mention is that the sort of the way it's sort of brought all together is the stage manager from our town is the one who introduces the play to you, and then he says, and here you'll see these familiar characters, first Blanche and Stanley, then George and Martha, and then Willie Loman. So we're all sort of introduced, and we're all coming to Stanley's home, the formerly Belle Reve, and for one reason or another, I'm going to New Orleans because my son is supposed to be there. Willie Loman's going because he's there to have some sort of a meeting. So it's all sort of loosely tied together, but some of the real comedy comes from everybody's interaction with these characters. Like Blanche has some wonderful moments with Willie Loman, which is, you never expect those two characters to be interacting, but they do. And Jim Selovich, who plays Willie, it's just a wonderful, wonderful parody version of Willie.
We're talking with three cast members for the Lakeside Players production of Death of a Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf, a spoof of actually four different great American plays. So we have with us Phil Yeager, Neil Rutatzel, and Clara Tappa, three members of the cast, each undertaking significant roles in this production. So Clara Tappa, so you've been, you've not been Blanche Dubois before.
No, I have not.
Oh, okay. But are you revisiting anybody you've...
Emily from Our Town.
So Emily Our Town. That's the character that you've done before. So what is it like to revisit a character that you have done in a sense purely or normally or correctly, however we want to say it, and to have to portray that character, I would guess, in a somewhat different way? Or are you playing it straight and just letting this crazy script kind of carry the rest of it?
In the case of Emily, I am playing it straight and letting the script take it. When I played Emily, I was in high school. So that was, just a couple of years ago, 30-some years ago. So it's very interesting to revisit a character from that long ago. But for Emily, I play it straight. Obviously, Blanche is quite the parody.
Yeah, in and of itself, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then how about you, Neil Rutatzel? Have you been Stanley Kowalski before?
No.
Done anything like him before, or was this completely a new adventure for you?
This is kind of a new adventure for me. I'm returning to theater after doing a few things in high school and raising a family and all that crazy stuff, and so I just on a whim auditioned and came into this scene. But my last exposure to Stanley Kowalski was college literature class reading the book and the novel or play.
Fine.
So, I love the character. I love the play. You know, I love all of these plays, and they're fantastic. But, as I get into this, you realize that, you can take this famous character who is really dark and brooding and just really a horrible person and move it into the caricature of what this play that we're doing now is all about. And it's really a fascinating experience to watch that transition of, myself on the first read of this, I'm reading all these funny lines, I'm going like, oh, we can have a lot of fun with this. And that's really what it's all about. I've been having a blast.
Wow, glad to hear. So how necessary is it for people to know these original works in order to catch the gist of all of this, or is that not particularly necessary?
No. I'm so glad you asked that, Greg. I was going to try to mention it. Yes, I think if you know these plays, it'll add to your enjoyment of the play, but the play is so well written and so humorous in and of itself. The situations and the craziness of all the people in this, especially Blanche DuBois. I mean, you know, in Tennessee Williams' original, she's not all there, you know, and she ends up going to the asylum. Our play begins where she's escaped from the asylum. And, you know, and to see, you know, a beloved character like her sort of played all out crazy is a joy. And I don't think if you don't know these plays, it'll affect your enjoyment of the show. There's a lot of references to other plays in the, you know, we refer to things like Waiting for Godot and Equus. So if you know theater, you know, some of the references, you'll get a little more enjoyment out of it. But I hope no one needs to read up before they come to see the play. They'll enjoy it in and of itself. Don't you all agree?
Absolutely. Agreed.
Yeah. Sounds like it. So how large a cast are we talking about?
Six people.
Yeah. Oh, so this is for you as cast members is a relatively intimate situation then.
Indeed. Yes.
What about production wise? What are things going to look like? What is the stage picture we see, or is it just that simple room? Is that where we are the whole night?
It is. It's in the Black Box Theater, the Skinner Hall at the Rhodey.
Okay.
So it's a very simple set, and it primarily takes place in the room of this plantation home, but of course we take the audience on a few little side trips. Mm-hmm.
I would hope, yes. Well, that sounds intriguing. Well, it sounds like amazing, good fun, and something I hope a lot of people are going to take the opportunity to see. So it's this coming weekend and the following weekend, six performances at all at the Rhodey Opera House in the Skinner Black Box Theater. Before we let you go, I think it would be interesting to hear from each of you a little bit about what initially drew you into theater in the first place. Phil, let's start with you.
Well, you know, I think going back, I actually thought about this recently. As a little kid, I was an only child, and my parents used movies as a babysitter. So I used to go to the movies a lot, even as a very young boy. And somehow, you know, seeing people pretending to be other people on the screen and then, of course, on television made me think, oh, I'd like to pretend to be other people. And then I started play acting, putting on my own little plays. And, you know, gradually that led to the, you know, finding out about stage acting. And by the time I was, you know, in high school, I was taking courses and, you know, acting and similar. And then I went to Carthage. I was a theater major. And you know, it grew out of my love of make-believe, basically.
Wonderful. That's a great story. And how many things have you done at the Lakeside Players over the years? Have you lost count, I suspect?
Yes. I've lost count.
Many, many, many.
A lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
No, that's
yeah,
great.
But I love it. I mean, Clara and I are lifetime members. We were given that honor by the organization. So, you know, when I met Clara, she was a junior in high school, and you know, it's she's one of my best friends, and you know, Neil is not only a fine actor, but I just have to say he's perfect for Stanley Kowalski. You'll see this man just doesn't portray the character, he embodies the character. Let's just say he's built.
Okay, all right. And he knows how to yell Stella, I hope.
Oh, so, God,
yes. We'll hear the story in a second. Clara, the other lifetime member, when did theater begin for you?
Oh, back in high school. It was just something fun to do. A friend was doing it, and I joined her, started in crew, and have just been doing it on and off ever since. It's just something very enjoyable. When you're playing someone else, you find yourselves yourself doing things that you would probably never do in real life.
So yeah, right.
It's a lot of fun.
So, and of many things you've done at the Lakeside Players, what would be a couple of high points for you?
A couple of high points would be the Wicked Witch of the West in Wizard of Oz. That was very fun.
I saw that. I enjoyed that production very much. The Dorothy was a former voice student of mine.
So. Yes, Sydney. She's fabulous. Yeah. Was a voice teacher for our daughter. Some people still ask me to cackle occasionally. and then Heidi and Heidi Chronicles. Just many plays. I always have fun. I always make new friends when I do a show, and this is no different.
Very good. So, Neil Rutasil, since this is a new venture for us, for you, first of all, you have at least dabbled in theater a little bit. I mean, when you were a young person, was that
right.
part of what you did?
Yeah. Yeah, I was a musician mostly, but I was the person that could sing on pitch in high school, and male casting for musicals kind of came to me. So I did that.
He played Joe Hardy in Damn Yankees.
In high school, yeah.
And where was this?
I grew up near Madison, near Oregon, Wisconsin.
Okay.
So that transitioned into being in a band in college. So I'm used to being on stage in front of people and entertaining and having fun with it. But as life kind of moved on, the last time I counted, the last time I was on stage was 1985.
Oh, my gosh.
So, this is a new thing for me. I'm like... Claire was saying, sometimes you got to do things that are a little bit outside the box. So I'm in a life transition right now. I'm changing jobs, changing kind of careers and transitioning that. And I just decided on a whim to do something that scares me. So I auditioned on a whim thinking that I'm never going to get a part, but mm-hmm. I'm just going to get on stage and do something that I think will raise my adrenaline level. And next thing you know, I'm cast in the play.
So, well, and if there's a role in theater that raises one's adrenaline level, I should think it's Stanley Kowalski.
I gotta say, it's really therapeutic to be on stage just yelling and being angry at people for a couple hours a night. It's been really fun because it's kind of not my personality.
So you'd have us believe that you're not Stanley Kowalski in real life.
No.
Very good. Well, I'm happy to hear that. And glad that you found your way back into the wonderful world of theater after more than 30 years. So quite a homecoming. So, Phil Yeager, remind our listeners about exactly when these performances are taking place and what they should do if they want to seek out tickets.
It opens this Friday. There are two evening performances each weekend at 7:30 and on Sunday at 2 p.m., this weekend and next weekend only. It ends, what's the
16th?
No, what is it? April, whatever it is, a week from Sunday. That's the closing night, or closing afternoon.
March 15th.
So it's a limited run, but hopefully there's a chance for everybody who's interested to see it.
The Black Box Theater does not seat a whole lot of people, though, so they should not delay in securing tickets.
Right.
So is it still 657-PLAY, the
play,
phone number?
Yes.
657-PLAY to secure tickets. So, again, the play is titled Death of a Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf, and we've been speaking to half of the cast, Phil Yeager, Neil Rutasil, and Clara Tappa. My thanks to all three of you for being part of the morning show, and best wishes with these wonderful, rollicking performances to come.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment.
Thank you.
This beautiful music is by Russian composer Reinhold Glier. It is the opening of his Concerto in B-flat major, Opus 91, for horn and orchestra. And it's really not every day that we get to hear this beautiful work performed, but that treat awaits anybody who attends the concert this weekend, March 7th, by the UW Parkside Orchestra. And Alvaro Garcia is going to be leading a concert that is going to include in the solo spotlight a very, very talented musician by the name of Rachel Velvicus, who is the artist in residence, the Howard Brown guest artist in residence at Parkside this week. And she will be performing this beautiful work, the Glier Horn Concerto. And we have both of them with us today on the morning show in this portion of the program to talk about all that's going on this week as Rachel comes back to town, working with various Parkside students, and of course also what's going to be on hand for this exciting concert on the 7th. Alvaro Garcia and Rachel Velvicus, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Well, hello.
Hi, thank you.
Good to have you here. Good to have you here. Rachel, I so vividly remember the first time I walked into the music store downtown and your proud father handed me compact disc that you and several of your friends, I think, had made.
Yes.
And he was so excited about this and really anxious for me to hear it. And although I don't know exactly where that disc is now, I was just blown away by the high quality of the new music and the high level of musicianship. It really was exciting. So I suspect that when you have a talented dad like that, it's just nearly inevitable that you're going to go into music, and here you have.
Yes, I was coming out of the womb singing, basically, and my dad was always blowing a trumpet into my face when I was a toddler. Ever since.
Well, we're glad he did, because it's been a really exciting story for you. We'll find out a little bit more in just a second. Alvaro Garcia, maybe you could say a word about this matter of the Howard Brown Artist in Residence program at Parkside, when that began and with whom, and kind of what it takes to put something like this together.
So I guess you could talk about many years ago, we used to have these galas in a Parkside of music galas of the music department. And Howard Brown was a regular at our galas, and he was always loved the symphonic music and came, and he was very happy to see us work with our students and so on. And he was really fun. Even if I finally remember my conversations with him. He was very happy of what the students were doing there at Parkside, and so I mean, they had some kind of an affection for our school. And it was then with his passing that Betsy Brown, his wife, established a fund for us to bring a guest artist in residence at Parkside. So we could actually, with the symphonic music, because we both of them love symphonic music, so can work with our students, these artists, when they come here and with the town, and kind of it evolved a little bit too, because not only this the guest artist comes here to town to work with our students at Parkside and with the orchestras, but also we are able to give back to the city by working with in this case is the Kenosha Unified District. So even as Rachel is doing rehearsals and working with our students at Parkside, she will be providing 3 master classes for the Kenosha Unified District at their high school. So we really thank the ability for KUSD to be able to work with us to do this. Scott Plank, the finance supervisor, and the 3 high school directors of Tremper High School, Bradford High School, and Indian Trail High School. So it's going to be an intense week for us, and I'm looking forward every minute of it. So, and that's the beauty of this fund, that will allow us to do this in basically on a yearly basis. So we started last year with Paul Cortez, as you remember, and this year is Rachel Velvicus, and I, as much as I can, I'll try to keep bringing someone who is of great talent that came out of the area, southeastern Wisconsin, to come here and somewhat give back to their hometown or so.
That seems like something Howard Brown himself would deeply appreciate, and I'm sure Betsy Brown appreciates deeply. That's fantastic. So, yes, we're recording this interview Tuesday morning, and right at the outset, I mean, I think you've just arrived in town pretty much, right? Or just about to begin.
I've been here, let's see, last night was my second night, so, and I've already given a masterclass at Parkside, and it was absolutely thrilling. I'm just absolutely stoked to be here and teaching at the local high schools, including Fantastic. Bradford, where I graduated.
Wonderful. So tell us, first of all, at what point you chose the French horn, and was that the instrument for you, or were you someone who tried out a couple of things, including your dad's trumpet, before finally settling on the French horn?
Yeah, I actually wanted to play the saxophone first, but there were so many kids that wanted to play it. It was very popular at the time, thanks to a certain president who would play it. And all the cool kids wanted to play it, and I wanted to be cool too. But unbeknownst to me, they gave me a reed that was too big in order to deter me. So I went to the French horn because my mom had previously played it, and so had my aunt. And they were just like, why don't you try this? So I did. I picked it up, and I could immediately play a scale, and I was like, all right, I don't have to work too hard.
Wow.
Famous last words. But
wow.
Yes.
Well, yes, because the French horn is such a tough instrument to master.
Yes.
And, of course, when one goes—
I picked a doozy.
Yeah, yeah. And when one goes to a band concert or a orchestra concert, if you hear any splats, it's often they come from the French horn because it's such an unpredictable instrument. I had the great privilege many, many, many years ago of interviewing Barry Tuckwell
in
the studio.
Rest in peace.
Yes, right. Just passed away not long ago, and I reran the interview. He was in Kenosha at the time when LeBlanc was here, and so at their invitation, I believe it was during the Kenosha Symphony's 50th anniversary season, he was a special guest on one concert. But I remember asking Mr. Tuckwell, so, you know, why is this? And he explained that the French horn is a relatively primitive and inefficient instrument, and which is why it is so difficult to master, and why even the finest players will tend to have mishaps more often than with other instruments. And then I asked him, so why don't they build a more efficient French horn? And he basically said that would change the sound. I mean, it's got this wonderful, almost primeval sound that wouldn't be there otherwise. If you changed it, it would sound a lot like a trumpet or something else. And nothing that there's any, not that there's anything wrong with a trumpet, but there's something very special about the French. Yeah, right. But so no, there's something very uniquely beautiful about the sound of the French horn. But part of the ingredient of that beauty is its difficulty.
I mean, but it is so worth it. You hear that soaring horn sound in any sort of even John Williams music. Your heart just melts.
Yeah, for sure. So did you have a relentless love affair with the French horn all these years, or did it ebb and flow?
Love, hate. There have been times where I may or may not have thrown it across the room onto a pile of blankets, for sure. But yes, that happens less and less these days as I practice more and more.
So tell us about kind of the trajectory of your career. It sounds like you were a pretty serious musician through middle school and high school and so
Absolutely.
On. Went to Bradford.
Yes, yeah. I actually, I'm a huge musical nerd fan. So I was actually in a Parkside show when I was in eighth grade, Fiddler on the Roof.
I saw that.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
I remember it. Yeah.
Yeah, and my mom was actually in school at the time there and with one of the costume people. So it was cool to work with her and the college kids, and I thought I was so cool back then. But yeah, I mean, even before that, I was always so, so into every single type of music. So it's just, I've just had that focus for as long as I can remember.
Once you graduated from high school, what did you do? What were the next couple of chapters?
Well, thanks to the great tutelage I had here in Milwaukee, I chose a teacher that suited me and my personality as well as my playing. And I went to school at the Manus School of Music in Manhattan, and I studied with David Jolly, international horn soloist. So ever since then, I don't know. It just kind of, I made all sorts of connections to be able to do what I do today. So
right. So explain kind of all the wonderful components of the life that you're enjoying right now, and the career in particular.
Well, I love traveling so much. It's wonderful. you kind of get used to airports after a while. At first, it's not very fun, but, you know, it kind of becomes routine. And that's when you truly get to enjoy the road and the experiences and the new people you meet. But when I'm not on the road, I'm lucky enough to have a rich freelance life in Richmond, Virginia. So I'm right in the middle. I'm right by Williamsburg and Norfolk and D.C., so it's really the perfect hub to be when I'm not on the road.
Right. How much chamber music do you get to do?
Oh, not enough, but I wish. Oh, yeah. I am lucky enough to be able to play quite a bit of chamber music. I mean, with my group, especially Seraph Brass, we tour a lot, and I'm able to play some of the best brass quintets out there. And we're actually commissioning a new piece.
Wow.
Yeah, to be... it's with wind ensemble and quintet, so that's going to be fun.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Rachel Vavukis, Kenosha's own, who is back in town as the Howard Brown residence, artist residence at the University of Wisconsin Parkside at the invitation of Alvaro Garcia, the conductor of the orchestra there. And she is here for a week of master classes and other special events, all which culminates Saturday evening, March 7th, in a concert at 7 o'clock in beautiful Francis Bedford Recital Hall, which will include a performance that she will give with the Parkside Orchestra of the Horn Concerto of Reinhold Glier. So, Rachel, being somebody still pretty darn young, how much teaching have you done and master classes and that sort of thing? Is this a relatively new venture for you?
Oh, no. I've been teaching since I was about 18 years old. I've had a private studio. I'm also on faculty at the University of Richmond. Hmm. Yeah, I've had a rich teaching life. And as far as master classes, I've given my fair share in my time. I hope to give a lot more. I actually just got hired to be on faculty at the Interlaken Festival this summer. Yeah, it's relatively new news. So
okay,
there it is, world.
So it sounds like this is something that is a relatively natural fit for you and something that gives you a lot of enjoyment.
Yeah, I enjoy it. I really do, yeah. Seeing talent, young talent, it reminds me of coming up here and experiencing the great teachers I had. So, it's really a blessing to be able to pass along what I've learned along the ways.
I was a little surprised when I read your resume of how much pop music was on that list. I mean, you know the list better than I do of all that you've experienced, but it's not the first thing we think of when we think of the French horn.
You mean you wouldn't equate the French horn with the James Bond cover band?
That's right, or Rolling Stones or Amy Grant or whatever. But I mean, it's really kind of intriguing to me that French horn can figure in those kind of musical adventures.
Yeah, I feel like the French horn gets a bad rap sometimes for people only thinking we can do one thing and not believing that we can actually play jazz. I'm so heartbroken that I don't get to play a lot of jazz because it's one of my favorite types of music. Mm. But, you know, there's so many jazz, a few jazz hornists out there. Rick Todd's one of them. Check out the Richter scale. it's a great album. But the French horn is so versatile, and my favorite gigs are the ones that I get to really let loose and go outside of the classical music box, so to speak. And really just kind of let it rip and fly and have a great time playing with a rock band.
So it isn't all Mozart and Strauss and Reinhold Glier.
Not to diss those guys. I love them too. But yeah, it's fun to go outside the box.
Fantastic. Alvaro Garcia, tell our listeners a little bit more. We're recording this on Tuesday, but about this week, which apparently has already included one master class already, but a little bit about what this week is going to entail for Rachel and your students.
Well, as we said initially, we have yesterday we just have our first rehearsal with the orchestra at nighttime, and also we have in the afternoon we have a masterclass at Parkside. I believe tomorrow we have
Tremper?
Yeah, it's Tremper. I don't have the list in front of me with me right now, but it is Tremper. Then we have Bradford on Thursday, and then we have Indian Trail on Friday. And those are master classes in their high schools where Rachel will be working with various groups, brass choirs, or small ensembles, or one-on-one students. So the school directors are preparing those students so they can play for Rachel in the end. And then the other part too is that which I think is the wonderful thing is for someone like Rachel, who was a graduate from Bradford, to be able to share her story and demonstrate to the kids that yes, even though you are in the ensemble where you are in the high school, you have a chance to make it out in the world and be a professional musician and be successful in life. So this is also the other part that. For me, I think it's very important that the kids in the high schools are able to see. Then, of course, Friday night we have our dress rehearsal in preparation for the concert, and then the concert Saturday night. So it's a pretty packed week, but I'll make sure I will give Rachel some free time also to enjoy family.
Once in a while, yes. I think they would be very pleased about that. Yeah. Very, very good. Very, very good. Rachel, say a quick word about this Reinhold Glier concerto that we heard the very beginning of. Anything in particular that makes it fun to play or fun for the audience to hear?
I call it the epic piece because it is just that. It has great sections of pure power, pure raw emotion in the middle section when it goes into this beautiful, beautiful cantabile section. And also the second movement is just gorgeous, and there's some cool stopped horn notes and mute changes and all sorts of good stuff. It's and the third movement just kind of goes by in one breath, it seems, and it's yes, got to be on my toes for that one.
Wow.
Tanking up.
Yeah. Well, it's not every day that we get to hear, you know, first of all, just a horn virtuoso, and a piece like this, it makes it an especially rare treat. And Alvaro Garcia, I know that you have this concert set up, as you often do concerts, in which we kind of begin in chamber fashion and then go to the full bore orchestra. So tell us what's planned for Saturday night.
So for Saturday night, we start with a more the classics in preparation. We normally, the structure of our concert, we start with a chamber group, then move to kind of chamber orchestra or full orchestra, and then, you know, full orchestra too. But in this case, we have a quartet. We'll have the dissonance quartet of Mozart, KV 465, and we'll do the second movement, kind of an introductory, and then we celebrate. It's just kind of the first stripes of celebration for Beethoven's anniversary of his birth, of course. And then we are going to be premiering the one of the symphonies that normally doesn't get played that often, which is Symphony Number 4. And we'll be doing the first movement for that. And you know, it has a lot of power, but, you know, it's one of those symphonies that they fall in between the what you will call either the radical symphonies of Beethoven, you know, for is more the more regular structure, but it has a lot of rough power and excitement, and that blends with Glier's power and excitement very well. So, and after that symphony, we'll do an intermission, and then we'll have the Glier with Rachel. So it's a very exciting concert. You know, fairly powerful, I will say, because of, you know, how Glier blends lyricism with excitement and quick rhythmic, you know, ideas that they come through in the most quick fashion of the Russian musical power.
Yeah.
As you say, it brings you a lot of remembrances of course, of Tchaikovsky and even Rachmaninoff. I mean, Glier being neo-romanticism, you know, it brings all that power back from the romanticism. And, you know, this concerto was written in 1950, I think it was. So it's, you know, well-versed into the 20th century. So when all that happened, so.
It's a great piece, and what a nice crowning climax to an exciting concert and to an exciting week. Really, really wonderful. So if people want ticket information about Saturday night's concert, you can go to uwp.eu and fairly easily find your way.
To search for tickets or even UW Parkside Rita tickets, and then you'll have a window there for buying as many tickets as you wish online.
And it's, of course, in beautiful Francis Bedford Recital Hall. It's just one of the crowning jewels of the community and a great place to make music and to hear music.
Yes.
And so on the stage of that lovely recital hall Saturday night will be the UW Parkside Orchestra and their very, very special guest artist, Rachel Velvikis. It was great to speak with both of you, you,
so
Alvaro
nice
Garcia, and especially you, Rachel Velikis.
A
wonderful treat to have you back in town.
So
I know a lot of people are excited to hear you play. So we'll leave everybody with the last couple of minutes of the opening movement of the Glier Horn Concerto in B-flat major. And again, thanks.
Helms.
Yes, yes. Hermann Baumann. The great virtuoso. And we thank both of you for being part of this portion of the morning show here on WGTD.
Thank you so much, Greg.
And the time is 8:58 here on WGTD. We want to remind you of the opportunity to subscribe to the Morning Show podcast, and you can hear a Morning Show 7 days a week rather than just 5 days a week. And this weekend, the Morning Show is going to include two wonderful podcast offerings. Tomorrow, Saturday, the author of the book Getting Into Guinness, a fascinating look at some of the people and what they have done to get into the Guinness Book of World Records. And on Sunday, the author of a tender book about adoption called The Brotherhood of Joseph. On Monday's morning show, I speak with best-selling author James Brown. His amazing new book is called Apology to a Young Addict, a memoir, in which James Brown talks about his own experience with addiction, as well as his experience of being sober, and in particular the work that he has done with other addicts over the last several years. That will be Monday on the morning show here on WGTD. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, featuring unique shopping in the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's